Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers, and today's conversation is with Beth Slavitt, member, Merit Systems Protection Board. And joining us in our conversation is Bob Reeve, another PwC partner.
Beth, can you describe the board's role in the personnel processes within federal government for our listeners and talk about the appeals process?
Yes. It's funny because in some ways, and a lot of people misunderstand this, we have a passive more than an active role in personnel processes, because while we have this studies function that broadly studies matters, if an employee will sometimes get letters of complaints from an employee. I got one a while ago that's saying, you should be responsible for dealing with all the personnel practices within the federal, and that's federal government, and that's not how we work. We have an individual case. It's a very passive role. We have an individual case that comes to us. We have to determine under the statute whether we have jurisdiction of the case, that is, whether we have the right to decide the case under the law that Congress has given us to administer. And those are the particular individualized cases that will come to us that we then get a chance to issue a decision in or not issue a decision in. An interesting case I remember a while ago was we've got some new statutes that we're responsible for administering more involving veterans' rights. And I remember reading some testimony from a hearing from a veterans groups and complaining that we hadn't taken jurisdiction over a particular case. We weren't deciding the case. Well, the fact of the matter is it was very clear under the statute we didn't have jurisdiction. So the other person may have had a problem. It was not something that was appropriate for us to reach out and to decide. If somebody thinks there is a particular violation of a merit principle and there's a prohibited personnel practice, the bodies they really need to be going to are either their Inspector General, their Office of Personnel Management, or the Office of Special Counsel, because, for example, the Office of Special Counsel is a prosecutorial agency, so they have the ability to investigate. Because we're an adjudicatory body, it's what you bring us, what information you bring us that we deal with. We don't have an investigatory arm, and people sometimes are confused about that. The way the appeals process typically works is usually an employee, based on our cases, comes to us, will get notice from their agency that they have a right to complain about something like, let's say, a suspension that was taken. They get 30 days notice. They file a complaint with us. It goes through our regional office. The regional office puts out an acknowledgement order saying this is what it appears your case is about. This is what your burden of proof is. This is what you have to do. They'll hold a pre-hearing conference with both sides, the agency and the appellant. They'll hold a hearing depending upon the case, and then they'll issue our decision. All of this will happen under our normal processing time in less than 100 days. Unless, as I indicated before, there's something really unusual about discovery or complexity or whatever, then that case can be appealed through a petition for review to the three-member board, where it will come in and go to the clerk's office, will accept it, will transfer it to the Office of Appeals Counsel, where I had mentioned there were about 35 attorneys there. They will make a recommendation to the three-member board. Each board member has their own staff, which reviews that recommendation and accepts it or rejects it based on what the board member wants. If the board member rejects it, it goes through a whole process where the board member will actually do a rewrite, saying, here's why I think the recommendation is wrong. Here's what the analysis that I would apply. They circulate that rewrite. If they get a second vote, it gets written up, and that would be the decision that ends up issuing as opposed to the recommendation of the Office of Appeals Counsel. Last year, I think we had 19 – We have a GEPRA goal, a Government Performance Result Act goal, of how often that should happen. And it varies between 9%, and last year it was 15%, where we actually rejected the recommendation of the Office of Appeals Counsel and went with a different recommendation.
Based on watching the appeals, what's your perspective on the practices that agencies could use to avoid being an appeal?
First of all, when there is an issue at the manager level, at the immediate manager level, from the very, very beginning, I think, and this is based more on my internal management experience than it might be from the case, but it's also some of the case, sometimes when I see particularly some of the disability cases, they need to talk. Management and the employee need to talk. The employee needs to know what they're doing wrong, how they can improve it, that there will be accountability, but also that what happened in the past, how you can learn from your mistake, move forward. The managers need support from their managers so that style of managing is appreciated and understood, so the dispute doesn't become a political game within themselves. They need to sometimes the manager make hard decision of saying, I don't think this employee should be removed. I think the employee needs to be suspended and be sent a strong message, but it's not an employee that we need to get rid of at this point. And I think they should use, there are a lot of alternative dispute resolution mechanisms in place. They should try to use those mechanisms. I went to a conference and heard of an interesting case that came out of the Postal Service where they had a terrible EEO backlog. And what was happening was the supervisor kept calling this one female employee by their mail carrier route, route number 6543. And this was at a conference involving a lot of Fortune 500 companies. The person brought an EEO complaint. Well, the EEO complaint had no merit because they weren't calling them that. The supervisor called all their employees by their by their route number, which was clearly not a good supervisory management practice, and somebody should have told him to stop it. But at some point, it had to get through this process and raised as through this EEO process before it could get to be resolved. That's silly. That's not very good management, and somebody should have been aware of that. But it wasn't an EEO problem, but it ended up becoming within the litigation framework when it really shouldn't have been.
Part of your mission is to provide oversight of the significant actions of the Office of Personnel Management. What are the challenges in this aspect of your mission?
Well, actually, the official mission is sunset, but we're still continuing to do it. We're about to put out a 10-year it's a 30-year, I guess, a 20-year retrospective with the emphasis on the last 10 years. And I think it's a tension here because with the Office of Personnel Management, they're a frequent litigator in front of us. They're always the party when it comes to retirement cases. They're also, if a case has got it has got significance across the government as opposed to a particular agency, they're the party who appears in front of us. And so I think there's a good relationship, but a different relationship between the staff of Office of Policy Evaluation, who work more closely with the Office of Personnel Management people on a day-to-day basis on the broader personnel issues. But I think there's also what I would perceive as a natural tension in that role and a line to walk of how much we're criticizing or suggesting changes to the Office of Personnel Management that they feel are really within their bailiwick, they're the personnel manager, and their perception perhaps that we're more employee-oriented anyway and we're going to reflect that perception. So I think it can be an uneasy relationship. I do think it's one that the career people in the Office of Policy Evaluation have established themselves as incredibly credible. So the relationship is good. But with regard to other sections of OPM, there is a natural unwillingness, I think, for example, to have a dialogue between, for example, the chairman of the MSPB and the head of OPM on policy practices, because so much a member of the board is seen as and is an independent decision maker. So what does that mean if an independent decision maker starts making policy recommendations? And it is a particularly a difficult line to walk on a question when we get a question from the Hill. Because we don't make, on the one hand, we do not make substantive policy decisions. And there was recent legislation that I commented on, the Whistleblower Protection Act. On the other hand, we have certain expertise in these areas, technical expertise. So how do you walk the line of making sure that people understand, the policymakers, OPM, understands the issues, at the same time you are upholding your independent status, which, you know, it's like being Caesar's wife. You have to you want to be as pure as you possibly can and not compromise that, and that can be difficult.
Well, that's it for this segment. So rejoin us in a few minutes as we continue our conversation with Beth Slavitt of the Merit Systems Protection Board. This is the Business of Government Hour.
Professors Catherine Knapp and J. Edward Kellogg examined diversity programs at the federal government agencies in their new report, A Changing Workforce, Understanding Diversity Programs in the Federal Government, sponsored by the PricewaterhouseCoopers Endowment for the Business of Government. This report is available at endowment.pwcglobal.com.